Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Is hair a material?
Are biscuits a material?
Are crystals a material?
Is plastic a material?
Is porridge a material?
Can gases be a material?
Are eggs a material?
Is water a material?
What do you call everything that isn't a material?
Sorry, I didn't mean to laugh at your question.
And yet you continue to do so.
Hello, and welcome back to Handmade, the making podcast with real talk about materials. I'm your host, Ada Pajaisky, and this episode I talked to artist Holly Graham about sugar. Holly is a supremely talented artist working in London, and as you'll hear, sugar is a material which has run throughout her practice for the last few years, both as a substance and as a sort of inspiration as well. She's also a good pal of mine, and I've been trying to get her on the podcast for ages, so I'm really glad that the UK lockdown finally gave us that opportunity to really sit down for an extended period of time and have this chat. Holly and I met at university. She's one of those annoyingly multi-talented humans because she's also an excellent singer, and we've played in the same Funk and Soul covers band for, I guess like 10 years now, which is kind of a scarily long amount of time. And because we hang out in that kind of guise, I've always been aware of her work. But since we're usually preoccupied with like rehearsals and gigs and stuff, it was actually so nice to really take some time and hear about her work, you know, at length for this podcast. But anyway, enough about our forgotten youth. Let's get into this conversation. I started by asking Holly how she became interested in sugar.
I think I developed an interest in sugar over a bit of a period of time, really. I was doing some volunteering at the V&A a few years back, where I was sort of giving tours as part of a sort of cohort of African heritage tour guides. And we were sort of trained up to look at the Europe galleries, I guess, with like a critical eye, and also thinking about an African presence in Europe throughout the time period that those galleries span, which is like 1600 to 1815, I think. And one of the objects that was in the galleries and that became sort of part of my tour were these sugar bowls. And yeah, they were really interesting objects. They were flanked by these sort of figurines they're meant to be representing Africa and the Americas. So depictions really, and like quite caricatured depictions of, I guess, like the labour, the enslaved labour that was like producing this substance, the sugar, which was really kind of flooding Europe at the time, and that was like fueling the European economy. So I was really interested in these bowls because they were like luxury goods in themselves. They were made out of porcelain, and they were sort of, yeah, a product that only, you know, very wealthy people would have owned, and that would have that they would have displayed on their tables for when guests came round, maybe for afternoon tea or something. but that they were this like visual testimony, I guess, to a very exploitative trade, and that they like really told the story of how that product had arrived on the table. So yeah, I'd been doing that, and then I also had a studio where I was sort of my studio is in Woolwich, and it's just opposite Tate and Lyle factory.
No way.
So I'd been like staring at Tate and Lyle for like ages and just like thinking about it like loosely in the background, like, yeah, you know, and it's still active and like there's still big boats that sort of like come along and like deposit, I guess, raw sugar, I don't really know, and like, wow, they take stuff up in like huge, like, I don't think they're called buckets, but that's what they look like. And then there's like steam coming out of the towers and stuff. So it's, yeah, it's still a very active factory. And then, yeah, a couple of years ago, I was invited to make some work for a gallery cafe. So it was Gerwood Arts, the project space there, which was located in the cafe. And all of this sort of like research I'd been doing previously and the sort of latent, I guess, thinking that had been like bubbling away, it felt like a perfect context to sort of bring some of those conversations out. Though I was quite resistant to it because obviously it's a really difficult history and therefore it's quite a difficult thing to make work around and to make sure that that's done like responsibly. And yeah. But yeah, I ended up making a body of work, which was sort of audio based. So I was talking to some of the other tour guides that I'd been working alongside and trained alongside, and also had a sort of visual element, which was in the form of these sugar lift etchings on steel. And so the etchings were not printed on paper. It was the sort of metal plates themselves that were exhibited, and they were made using a process that uses sugar to create these tonal elements as well.
Nice. So you were using the material as kind of like as a chemical as well as a kind of political substance and exploring all of that space as well. So what is this process of sugar lift etching then? Because you sent it to me in our little email exchange and I'd never heard of it. So I'd love to hear a bit more about kind of how you do it and what it involves.
Yeah, it's really cool actually. Like it's I think one thing about printmaking materially is that it has a lot of big reveals, so it's quite an exciting process to work with, because although there are some things you do within the processes that are very like direct, there's a lot of things that you don't have any control over, and that when you're sort of like doing the next phase of the process, you're like, what's gonna happen, what's gonna be on the other side. So yeah, with maybe to start just with etching itself, usually with etching you're using a metal plate, so that could be any number of metals. It could be steel or zinc, copper, aluminium, and usually you have a flat plate of this metal, and etching is part of like a series of a collection of sort of printmaking techniques or processes called intaglio, or sort of linked to engraving. So in this process, you're using a plate and making indents on the plate, and it's those indents that you sort of rub the ink into, and when you print from the plate, the ink within the grooves or within the sort of bits that are kind of lower down on the plate print onto the plate, onto the paper.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. And so that's like in contrast to say relief printing, which some people might know, like a lino print or a potato print, where you roll ink onto the surface and it prints on the bits that are raised, not the bits that have been carved away or dug out of. So that's etching, and usually the way that you do that is that you would expose the metal plate to acid or a mordant. So I found out, actually, I feel like I used to know this, but I was reminded of it recently, like the other day when I was like thinking about this podcast, that the word mordant is rooted in Latin and it means to bite, I believe. And we talk about that a lot in etching. We talk about like allowing the acid to bite the plate, or what depth of bite the acid has. So yeah, I think that's quite a nice like visual as well for like how the acid eats away at the metal. So what you need within etching to create an image is you need usually an acid resist. So you're layering onto the plate before you do anything else. A layer like a waxy resin maybe, or a varnish, and then you're taking away areas of that either with like a tool or another process like within sugar lift, which we'll talk about in just a second, and those areas that are exposed, say you scrape away at that waxy covering, are then eaten by the acid when you put that into an acid bath. So if that all makes sense, with sugar lift, with the process of sugar lift, you're using a sort of sugar solution as part of the process of revealing areas of the plate to then be eaten by the acid. So the full process would be that you'd have your metal plate, and then you'd have a sugar solution, and that might, it could easily just be like water and sugar, a syrup, but traditionally it would have been like coloured somehow so that you'd be able to see it on the plate. So originally it might have been like Indian ink mixed with sugar, or more recently it might be camp coffee, which I don't know if you know it, but it's like a chicory based very sweet syrup which is used to make a sort of coffee substitute. They sell it, okay, in Sainsbury's. It's pretty old school, but I have a friend who says that it's really nice. But yeah, so another, like, the reason that's used is just because it is basically syrup, but it's dark so you can see it, it shows up on the plate, and so usually you'd then paint your design, whatever that is, onto the metal. And a really nice thing about this process is that usually you can like pick up some really interesting marks. So if you're painting onto a plate, it picks up often like the brush marks, so you can get like quite a painterly mark on something that's actually like metal, which is like, you know, very exciting if you're an art nerd like me. Yeah, so you paint it onto the plate, and then you wait for it to dry, or you can like dry it a bit with the hairdryer and it sort of goes a bit tacky, and then you pour over varnish. And so in this case, your varnish is your acid resist, and usually it'd be quite thinned down with like white spirit if that's like the base. So I usually use like a bitumen based varnish, thinned down, pour that onto the plate, so it has a really thin covering, and then you put the plate in hot water, and it's, yeah, I guess that's where like the big one of the many big reveals comes in, because you've got this plate which is just basically black, and it's quite scary because especially if you spent a long time like putting your image onto the plate, then yeah, to just cover it in this like black varnish, or yeah, it's quite quite a move. But you put it into the hot water and you start to see like little bubbles in where you've put down the sugar. And slowly those like open up, and then you can use like a brush or a feather if you want to get old school to to start to like disturb the water a little bit, and to help the sugar sort of start dissolving and lifting the varnish off in those areas. And so that's how you create your image, in a sense, in that you've revealed those areas that are then going to be bitten by the acid.
Amazing. And that's all because sugar loves water, loves dissolving in water. Yeah. More chemistry.
Yeah.
I was really amazed by the level of detail that you were able to get. I had a look on your website at some of the etchings. I was amazed by A, the level of detail that is possible, and B, the contrasting shades that are possible, because in like some of the other printing processes that you described, it's either colour on or colour off. There's no that, in a very basic way, I felt that there wasn't much room for nuance, but I was really it was kind of delightful in a way how much shading is possible with this approach.
Yeah, well, there's a couple of things there, which is that often Sugarlift is used alongside another sort of sister technique called aquatint, which is a method for creating like layers of flat tone. And with that, you sort of lay on a dust resin, you burn or you like melt on a dust resin. And when you put that in the acid, that acts as the acid resist. So you can put it in for different lengths of time.
Okay.
And the longer you put it in, the deeper the bite goes into the little, you know, holes between the bits of resin. So you can use both Sugarlift and aquatint together to like reveal different areas for different lengths of time, so you can create like a different tonal variation that way.
So you don't just dip once, you could do a series of dips for different lengths of time.
With different amounts of the plate revealed. But in my case, I've used a slightly different process, which is that I've screen printed the sugar on. So I use treacle because it has a different consistency, and because I wanted to work sort of like directly with the photographic imagery. But I didn't use aquatint. So yeah, there is like a real variation of tone there, but that's more created by like the photographic image and how that's sort of built up.
Nice.
If that makes sense.
It does. It does. It all makes sense. So we've mentioned the different metals that you can do it on and the substances that you can use to protect the metal against the acid. What are the acids that you're using to attack, to bite the metal?
So it's a good question. So it depends on what metal you're using. So usually you'd pair whichever metal you're using with like an acid that like corresponds. And yeah, I think it is quite interesting that like as an artist, I don't know a lot about the chemistry of this. I sort of just like take it for granted. So I know that like with steel, I'd put it in like ferric acid, but you know, and I can like hazard a guess as to why that might be, but I don't really understand. And I'm sure you probably have a lot more information about what is going on there.
I would like to say that I did. I'd actually have to do quite a lot of reading to understand exactly what it is. But I do remember the only etching processes that I'm familiar with are in my undergraduate like labs at uni. We would have to study metals under a microscope and all of the different grain structures in the metals. And the process was really long and dull, but basically you have to put a piece of metal and embed it into a kind of resin puck, a bit like sort of an ice hockey puck or like a squat cylinder shape. And then you have to grind and polish that for hours so that the surface is really, really smooth. And then you have to dip that in acid. And like you were saying, which acid depends on which metal, but the acid attacks the boundaries between the grains and like increases the contrast of what you're looking at down the microscope. That's all I know about etching. All I remember is that once we had a really terrifying acid called HF, I think it's like hydrofluoric acid, and that's an acid where if you get any on your skin or like any body part, it will like eat into the flesh immediately and like attack your bones and stuff. It's really horrendous.
That's so scary.
And yeah, we had to use that as undergraduates, and I just remember like holding this piece of metal, like my hand shaking in a little beaker of acid. Anyway, hopefully the ones you're using are significantly less dangerous.
Yeah, I think they are. Yeah, So I've been doing a lot of etching on aluminium in more recent work. And with that, I've been using saline sulfate. And I've like taken that into schools for workshops and like other places. And that's like, you know, it's pretty like okay, and it doesn't give off any like really harmful gases. I believe it only gives off hydrogen.
Cool.
And it's quite exciting to watch as well, because it's like you have these like copper sulfate crystals, which are like this really bright turquoise.
Nice.
And then you've got just like table salt, so that's like obviously very familiar substance. And you mix those together with hot water or warm water. And then you've got this like amazing, like greeny blue liquid. And then when you put the aluminium in, it's like,
nice.
And so it's like really exciting to watch, but not like scary in most, unless you like put too many in. And then it's nice to see as well, because the copper like separates out. And so you get like this quite like muddy copper residue forming at on the top actually at first, but then it sinks to the bottom, so you can really see like, it's quite weird for me to like look at these crystals and think that there's copper in them, but
yeah,
like seeing that transition is cool.
So you sort of hinted a bit there at quite a long history of sugar lift etching. How long has this process been about?
So we know that like etching or engraving more really dates back to like antiquity. And we've like seen that on like bones and into shells and like precious stones and things. And I think also etching processes using like alkali as well as acids to eat away at the surfaces of some of those materials is like you can sort of see that in different ancient civilizations. But I believe the first etching on paper was made in 1515 by Dürer, and it's quite well known, so you might have seen the image kind of circulating, and it's of a rhinoceros.
By someone who had never seen a rhinoceros, is it that one?
And I think that's really interesting in and of itself, because it really speaks about the time. So Dürer was German and spent like quite a bit of time in Italy, but a European artist making a sort of image of quite an exotic creature, which wouldn't have been anywhere nearby, but which would have been from like being told about what this creature looked like, and maybe from other depictions or drawings. But it really kind of reflects the sort of beginnings of expansion and travel and exploration, which then kind of took on a colonial legacy from that time forward, actually. But prior to that, also, I guess, etching processes had been used more for things like armour making and like jewellery and silverware as well. And so apparently a lot of the sort of early artists who were making etchings on paper actually had backgrounds in like silversmithing and other processes, which I thought was quite interesting. But yeah, the first we hear of sugar lift as a process is a little bit later. So an artist called Paul Selby in 1776 coined the term sugar lift, as well as aquatint, actually, although we sort of know that aquatint experiments were happening a little bit before that. So yeah, I think that's also quite interesting and a sort of reflection on the time as well, because 1776, I mean, yeah, end of the 1700s, that's sort of the height of the sugar trade, and I guess which is inextricably linked to the slave trade, the transatlantic slave trade. So it makes total sense that maybe artists would have been starting to experiment with this material at a time when it was becoming sort of more present in Europe. I mean, it has other histories of being used as an artistic material in quite different ways. So so one of the ways that that was would have been for making sort of figurines, decorative figurines for tables, for like dinner tables, for big feasts and things. So those were called subtleties, which is quite a cool name because I can't imagine they were very subtle. and they were really like a huge show of like wealth and power. And those would have been in all sorts of different forms. Like they would have depicted animals and buildings, and sometimes they carried religious messages, quite often sort of like less overt or more overt political messages. So I guess that's like one way that sugar would have been used, but as an artistic material. But at that time, it was so like scarce and rare, and the supply wasn't in as great quantities as it was at that later point, that it meant it was this sort of really lucrative it was seen as a substance that was incredibly valuable, and that's why it sort of like took on that that status as a show of wealth.
That makes sense.
And would only really have been available to very, very wealthy people.
And that goes back to your initial inspiration of those porcelain figurines, right? Because that porcelain in itself was a very expensive and highly sought after material. And so to make that as an object which was to hold sugar is kind of like a double whammy of like showing off of your wealth.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And apparently there is like a direct lineage in that those sugar paste models did directly inform the sort of later porcelain models that would have been made to decorate tables. So,
interesting.
Yeah, a direct sort of like design line between the two. Yeah.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
So when you were going about thinking about using sugarlift etching to communicate some of these histories and stories around the enslavement of people and their role in the sugar industry, what was your approach to communicating those things?
I think a big reason that I wanted to sort of embed the materials into the work, the sort of, as in I wanted to embed the kind of sugar and the steel as well, if we think about industry that was sort of like fueled by that sugar, was so that it was, so that I guess these substances were like really at the heart of the work in every level. on every level. And yeah, I don't know, it was quite a slow process in some ways, in that I was really thinking through how to grapple with having these conversations and with ensuring that it was done in the right way. So it's in a cafe space, the original work, although it's like threaded itself through a lot of my practice since. So it was going to be sort of in the background, and lots of the images that I was sort of making through these etchings were of the sort of hands and arms of many similar porcelain figurines. And so that was sort of thinking a lot about sort of processes of labour as well, and in these sort of gestures, which are sort of like gestures of servitude, like they're gesturing towards the bowls and presenting them to whoever's like eating from them. And so I was quite like, I felt quite, they're uncomfortable images as it is. And I was aware that it could be quite problematic to sort of like display these sort of limbs on the wall without like much more context around them, and without asking people to sort of like properly interrogate them or confront the conversations within them. And so I think in part that was why I felt it was really important to have the audio there and those conversations with some of the guides who'd done all of this research and had all of these different, these also just very different approaches and sort of relationships to the objects. And also we just spoke about sugar as well, and, you know, our primary relationship, most people's primary relationship with sugar is in like just eating it, and it's so embedded in culinary culture here in the UK, like, you know, cakes, biscuits, tea, and so I think, yeah, it's a really nice way in to have some like quite difficult conversations. But yeah, I felt like I was sort of, it was a difficult process, like grappling with how to navigate that, if you like.
Yeah,
so we started off, so I did like lots of separate interviews, and we started by speaking about a favourite recipe.
Don't boil it too much so that it becomes hard.
You put the syrup sort of and the treacle and the butter and the brown sugar, all sugars, over a gentle heat.
Bring to a stir
in the flour mixture. Mix in the beets and egg.
Milky white to clear.
Making sure that the butter is melted and the sugar and honey are dissolved.
And a pinch of salt.
Pour into a baking tin.
And it's just pure sugar.
So most people, yeah, spoke about just a recipe that either they enjoy making themselves or that they grew up with. And yeah, there were all sorts of different tasty treats. And it was really fun to speak about, because obviously, like, people do just love sugar for the most part.
I love sweet things.
I do. Yes, I've got a very sweet tooth.
I love sweet things. Mm. I love desserts.
I do, for my shame. Favorite.
Favourite part of the meal.
Yes, unfortunately.
I'm salivating right now.
Just thinking about them.
That's
the
fact, that's why I have problems with my teeth. I think it stems from childhood.
I have to say, I'm as well. An indulger in cakes and biscuits.
Salivating right now.
I, for one, don't actually have any sugar in my tea.
My palate always likes some sugar, so as long as I know that it's got sugar in it, I'm sure I'm going to like it to some extent.
One of the nice stories that came out of it was someone speaking about a Caribbean rum cake that their brother-in-law would make, and it's the secret family recipe, and they won't tell anybody what the secret ingredients are. And I thought, yeah, that was just like a really like beautiful sort of moment of somebody really speaking about some of the like more personal narratives that we have connected to sugar as a substance.
And I suppose also taking that substance and building your own stories and your own traditions with it is quite an important part of the whole story of sugar in a way.
Yeah, definitely. I guess it's really interesting to like think about these conversations, and actually you could do a spotlight on like any number of materials, which I guess you're doing, and like, but pull out some of the sort of questions of sort of like provenance and like movement and how these things have sort of circulated as well. And they'd reveal so much about like, yeah, where we're situated and how we live and, you know, and I think it's a really useful conversation. It's a really interesting conversation to have. And I feel it feels very like at the moment, you know, we're in the aftermath of like several recent, I guess, murders of like black men by American police. And we know that's like an entrenched ongoing problem. And we know it's not it's not separate from also our sort of experiences in the UK. And I think it's really useful to be able to sort of like trace a line between something that seems as far removed from that as sugar to like current circumstances here today.
And as sugar is such an everyday object, is kind of a nice metaphor for the fact that, you know, this is a systemic problem and we all participate in that system, and we all have a part
Absolutely.
To play to changing that system.
Yeah. In doing the sort of research around it, I was finding so many little threads that like sort of connected up lots of different dots. So one of those being like the link between slavery, the sugar trade, and the Industrial Revolution, which like I learned about the Industrial Revolution at school like everyone else, and I didn't learn that, you know, this was fueled by like the economy that was generated from transatlantic slavery and from in large part sugar. And so I think some of those like gaps are really useful to sort of talk about and to like join up the dots to be able to have like a more comprehensive understanding as well of like, yeah, our current like lived experience. Mm-hmm. And when you sort of start to think about, I guess, like the economic sort of repercussions of that, then you can really see like a ripple effect into the present day. I think it was, there was a Treasury tweet which came out like a couple of years back, which I think the conversation around that has like resurfaced recently, which was, I think it was basically saying like, oh, don't forget, like British taxpayers have still been like paying off the debts of abolishing slavery.
Yes.
And that was through sort of compensation to slave owners. Right up until 2015, taxpayers have been like paying off those debts, which weren't, you know, which is like obscene to think about, and obscene to think about in terms of like who was being compensated within that. And so yeah, I think lots of these histories as well, which seem really distant or, removed, are actually like so present, and we're sort of like swimming in them in a very current way.
Exactly. Yeah. And so to think about sugar today, you know, your whole, I suppose, artistic journey with this started with those objects in the V&A Museum, the Victoria and Albert Museum, which is in itself an institution of the kind of Victorian time and empire, mm-hmm. and all of that kind of stuff. And there are definitely, like you say, there's so many stories to be told, and there are lots of different ways that we can tell those stories, and one of which is in those institutions. I suppose this is quite a broad question and probably very difficult to answer, but do you have any sense of what might be some of the best ways to start amplifying those stories? Is it in museums, or is it in artwork like yours, or any other ways?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know if there are like, yeah, I mean, I think maybe an answer is in like all the ways that are physically possible. I mean, there are a lot of conversations around like decolonizing the curriculum, like, actually I guess the starting point or like a fundamental place these conversations should be being had are in schools. So like we need to be teaching like a full rounded history in the classroom, because yeah, I think a big part of like when we think about what it is to teach British history is actually it's to think about British history expansively and not in this kind of very linear way that privileges like one colonial narrative. So I think schools is like one answer. I think, yeah, I really enjoyed doing the tour guiding in museums, and I thought that was a really good, useful and important way of like opening up some of the narratives behind these like thousands and thousands of objects, which like just have so much to say. But you know, walking through a museum, you're often like overwhelmed by the vast like quantity of stuff, and you know, there's just like there's bits of information, but there's like only so much you can take in, and it is very difficult to like find a way in. So I think having like someone to just have a chat with about it is like great, and those tours were free, which is really good. I think actually probably not enough people know that like that's there, and the V&A actually had like loads of tours all the time, like every day, that were just free. And you know, there's something to be said for like, you know, they were all run by volunteers, and like that can be like questioned as well.
Yeah,
and challenged, but it's definitely a good way for people to sort of start accessing those conversations. But yeah, on the other hand, there's a lot of artists who are doing some really interesting and I think some quite important work in those areas too. So Kara Walker, quite a well-known American artist, who showed recently at the Turbine Hall at Tate Modern over here. She made a work a few years back now, I think 2014, called A Subtlety or The Marvelous Sugar Baby. And it was a huge sort of monumentally sized sugar figurine, sort of, as you can imagine, inspired in part by these like subtleties, these decorative figures for the table, made out of sugar. And so this was the head of a black woman and the body of a lion. And it was made for the Domino Factory in New York, which was a sugar factory, which was sort of like no longer functioning. So again, like drawing on these histories of sugar and enslavement, and thinking about like the labour that sort of carved out the sort of America of today. Some other sort of artists working with that. Zinzi Minot, I know, is doing a kind of ongoing research project called Type 2, thinking about diabetes as well and the body and sugar. And she has a dance-based practice. Lots of things going on. I think an artist called Gala Bell made a sugar head, what's it called, a bust out of sugar of Henry Tate, I think last year. And yeah, again, thinking about some of those kind of dynamics of sugar and power. I know Jennifer Martin as well is another artist working in sort of like video and photography, and has been doing a series of work thinking about like immigration policy in the UK and exploring that through the metaphor of teeth, which also sort of like dips into histories of sugar at times. So, yeah.
Wow. Such a diverse like range of approaches, I suppose, to this one material.
Yeah.
So what does sugar mean to you today?
As we sort of talked about a bit, you have an inevitable like disassociation between like the material sugar that you know and like eat or consume in that way. And then like some of the histories of it, which for me are quite present because I'm researching it a lot in my work. But I think for the vast majority of us is fairly removed. And lots, I think what's interesting is that a lot of people actually don't know about it, which I think is a funny one when I feel like whenever you know something, it can be quite hard to sometimes pinpoint like when you found out these things, and like particularly if you've got like an ongoing developing understanding of something, it can feel like quite, some of the things can feel quite obvious. But I've spoken to some friends who say like, oh God, I'd never even thought about that in terms of like afternoon tea or anything. And I'm like, what?
Yeah.
So I think, yeah, there's, you know, some people just don't know about some of those histories. And then some people do know about it, but it's impossible to hold all of these things in your mind all the time and on the day to day. And then again, like another relationship I have to sugar is like in the studio, and this like process based one, where working with it feels is quite sensory in a way, because like when you screen print the sugar or the treacle onto the plate, it smells amazing. And I have like a ritual when I open like a new tin of treacle, I like have a spoonful first because I'm just like, oh, I can't not.
Amazing.
But yeah, so I've got all of these different relationships with it, but yeah, it's difficult to hold them all together at once. I think my usual one, or like my main everyday one, is probably the one that most people living here have every day, which is like eating a biscuit, or like I have sugar every day on my porridge, which is probably quite bad for me. So yeah, I think what it probably means to me is it's a substance which is delicious and addictive, and which carries like so much narrative and like historical weight with it. And I see it as like a really useful way into having some quite difficult discussions about difficult histories.
So that was the amazing Holly Graham. I'm so happy to have finally got her on the podcast. And thanks very much, Holly, for taking the time to come on. If you've been interested hearing about sugar in this episode, Holly has compiled a recommended reading and listening list, which I've put in the show notes if you want to learn more about it. If you want to see more of her work, her website is www.hollygraham.co.uk, and her Instagram is Holly C. A. Graham. I also want to say thanks to Holly for allowing me to use some of those audio snippets from her work in the middle of this podcast. If you'd like to hear the full recorded piece, you can have a look on Holly's website, which again is www.hollygraham.co.uk, and you can listen to the full thing there. So that's all for this time. If you've enjoyed this episode on sugar, then I recommend that you go back and listen to the previous episode on sugar, which was with artist and researcher Ellie Doney. If you're enjoying the podcast as a whole, it would be great if you would rate and review the podcast. You can come and say hi to us on Twitter. We're at Real Talk. That's R-I-A-L Talk. Or if you want to send a longer message, we've got an email address, which is realtalkpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks as always to Dave Shepherd for our wonderful cover art, and to Alex Lathbridge for the music mix. Next time, we'll be hearing from archaeologist and anthropologist Michael Rivera on bone. So until then, take care, thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time on Handmade. Hi, it's me again. Just before you go, I thought I'd put a little bonus feature on the end of this episode, if you're still listening to the bitter end. I mentioned earlier that Holly and I play in the same band. Well, we've been missing each other a lot over the UK coronavirus lockdown, and we've managed to put a new track together from our bedrooms. On this track, you'll hear from a whole load more of my multi-talented friends. Almost nobody on here, in fact, is playing the instrument that they actually play in our actual band. But anyway, it's been mixed and mastered by Ajay Ratan. So here is Don't Freak Out at Home with our debut lockdown jam called RIP Band Practice, Half an Hour Late.
I was sort of imagining, like, I want the band back together, cannot wait. Wait, because everyone is always half an hour late.
Fair enough.
I was reading it more like, I want the band back together. Everyone is always late. Half an hour late. Band back together, I cannot wait. Band back together, I cannot wait. Wait, because everyone is always half an hour late.
Is always half an hour late.
Band back together, I cannot wait.
Wait, because everyone is always half an hour late.
Band back together, I cannot wait. Wait, because everyone is always half an hour late. Band back together, I cannot wait. Wait, because everyone is always half an hour late. Half an hour late. Half an hour late.
Half an hour late.
Half an hour late. Half an hour.
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 Half an hour. Half an hour late.
Late.
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 Half an hour late.
half an hour late.
Oh my gosh, this is too funny. I don't even know who this guy is.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.